just water, which I'll open. Mm. I'll pre-open.
Been over to this like far edge of the convention center a couple times now. Yeah. Everything is so spread out.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's huge.
And I actually I got the room wrong for this, so I showed up at F151 or something, and I was like, this is even farther, and there's a restaurant set up in here. This is not the right place.
Leave about one more minute just to see what women can find their way to this long winding trail to get to this room. You've all done very well to get here. We did too, didn't we?
Yes.
Yeah. What you may not know, which I could ask you, is that this is also the annual meeting of the UUWF. So how many of you here in this room are members of UUWF? Let's see if we have a few members.
A few? Yeah.
All right, so you will be able to say, yes, I went to the annual meeting. Okay? All right, I think we'll begin. This is program 419. Bold Spiritedness, a New Prophetic Sisterhood. So I hope you're in the right place. My name is Kirsty Lewis, and I am the current president of the board of the UU Women's Federation. Now, the UUWF has a long history. It goes back to the merger as the UUWF, but it goes back probably 100 years before that both the Unitarians and the Universalists had very active women societies and organizations. I think one was called the Women's Alliance and another one was called the Women's what? Association. And now we are the UU Women's Federation. We are proud of the history of what women have done in this movement. There is a long history of raising women's voices and working on behalf of women, and we are still raising our voices today. I hope we keep on raising our voices as long as we can, as long as we have one. I'd like to apologize to anybody who was at the workshop on Let Ours Be No Silent Witness with Dr. Cynthia Grant Tucker, because you will hear something now that you heard then, at least in my remarks. So apologies to you for hearing it twice. I am not going to go back over our illustrious past. There are many accomplishments that women have engaged in the years past, and you can go to our website, uuwf.org, pretty easy, and read about some of the things that we have been doing in the past. We have been giving grants, we have been doing various kinds of active activities, and that's how you can find out about it. But today, rather than extolling our past virtues, I want to say a few things about what the UUWF is doing now. We have, unlike some associations, we have some money in the bank, and we want to give that money away. We have done so in the past, and we are continuing to do so. The board has decided that we would like to give more money for fewer projects so that we can have a bigger bang for our buck. So that is one thing that we are doing, and I will tell you a little bit more about what we have funded for this year in a minute. But first of all, I also want to tell you on that UUWF.org website, you can become a member of the UUWF with a push of two or three buttons, and tell us your email address, and you will be on our email list, which is approaching 3,000 now. Plus, another thing we would like you to do is to go to our Facebook page and friend us. We're closing in on 1,000 friends on Facebook, because we do believe that the numbers count. As the numbers rise, maybe our voice as a collective voice gets louder. So join us. A donation of any amount is just terrific, $5 to $5,000. whatever you can give, and become a member. Becoming a member means that you are part of our voice. And we are doing advocacy work, we are doing educational work, we are doing funding work. So that's what you're getting. And we know that there are many things that women need to say, and we are helping to say them. So let's see, what shall I tell you about next? All right, let me tell you about what we're funding this year, because I want to get onto the panel as soon as I can. But this is a little bit about what we're going to talk about today, because this is our big funded project this year. It's more or less an internal project that came out of our conversations, and it's called, you know, A New Prophetic Sisterhood, Bold Spiritedness is our workshop. So this project is being spearheaded by Reverend Marty Keller, and she will tell you much more about it. It is about UU women ministers collectively learning or agreeing or planning to raise their voices in our pulpits, in our congregations. So they will be talking about that in a moment, and I will tell you more about each of our panelists in just a moment. But I want you to also know, thirdly, that we have been doing a survey. How many of you have been past our booth and picked up our little survey card? Okay, well, we are wanting to do this survey. We did a survey in 2004, so it's been over 10 years. We want to find out what are the big issues on women's minds these days. But not only that, we also want to find out how well are our congregations dealing with these issues. Do you hear about them from the pulpit? Do you hear about them in your congregation, in your congregational activities? So it gives you an opportunity to tell us about the women's groups that you're in, maybe in your congregation, or maybe the women's groups that you're not in. But we're collecting this information, and after September 1st, we will be posting the results of this survey. But I'm going to give you some early results right now. We have heard from more than 200 people. 200 women have answered our survey. We don't know how many we're going to end up with, but you could still be one. But these are what we've learned so far. We learned that, I'm going to tell you the top five most important issues. And I don't think these will be a surprise to you, but here's what they are. The first one was economic justice and equal pay. That's number one. Number two, also not a surprise, reproductive justice. And some of you who have been to our booth, I hope, have signed our thank you card for Governor Kate Brown. She has passed a piece of legislation which is positive for women, in which women can get birth control prescriptions for a year at a time instead of 1 month at a time. And so we're sending her a giant thank you card. So if you haven't come by our booth and signed that, please do. Anyway, so that's our second most important issue, reproductive justice. Third one, gender-based violence, also not a surprise. Fourth one is climate change. And of course, I think we're learning very quickly that climate change disproportionately impacts women, right? More than men, because the women are the ones in the family, and they are very affected by this in many countries. And the fifth one is women's health care in general. So there are some other issues that may be important to you, so come to the survey site, which is you can go to the website and get to the survey, and let us know what they are. Now, the other questions we had are, how much is your congregation paying sufficient enough attention to women's issues? Well, the answer to that is that 48% of our responders said, yes, they are. 35% said no, and 15% said they didn't know. Maybe it's hard to decide, you know, what is sufficient attention, but you can decide that for yourself and tell us. Is your minister paying sufficient attention to women's issues? Well, similar. 51% said yes, he is. She is, he is. Sorry, I'm not going to say that. 51% of the minister said of the respondents said yes. 28% said no, and 20% didn't know. Now, we also asked them to tell us some stellar names of some ministers that they felt were doing a really good job of holding up women's issues. So I'm going to just read you not the names of the ministers, but some of the churches that came out as doing a really good job. for women. And one of these was Abraham Lincoln Church of San Jose. If this is your church, you can, you know, say yay. St. John's UU Church of Cincinnati. UU Church of Tippecanoe. Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of North Nevada. First Unitarian Church of Dallas, Texas.
Woo-hoo.
I know there's some people from there. Woodinville UU Church. Terre Haute, Indiana. Salem, Oregon. So there are a lot of churches that are doing a good job. We heard that at least 50% are doing a good job. So, you know, nominate your own church if you feel they are doing a good job. All right. About 40% of the women who responded to our survey belong to a women's group in their congregation. I was a little surprised at that number, 40%. I thought it would be higher. But 40% are in some kind of a women's group, but we didn't specify what kind. But the 59% are no then. How many women are or are you involved in district or regional activities? About 22%. Yes, 78% no. On the national level, yes was 17%. In other words, women who are working on a national level or involved on a national level, about 17%. That's pretty good too. All right. How many were, and this is very interesting, how many of the responders are UUWF members? 20% were members. 44% were not members. 14% did not know if they were a member. And 20% had been a member previously, but were not at this moment. So we would like to be sure that you know whether or not you're a member. So please let us know if you're confused about that. And join again in case you don't know. All right. 88% of our responders belong to a UU congregation. So that is our survey up to date for now. But as I said, it's not over. I want to read you a quote from one woman that I think summarizes something very interesting. And after that, I will introduce our panel. So listen to this. Women's full rights are the outstanding civil and human rights issue of our time. This should be an unapologetic focus for UUs. As a gay person, I think it's great that 10% of the population has gotten so much attention and made so much progress. But I wonder why that seems to be moving forward faster than the rights for one half of the population. So thinking about that. All right. Now, I'm going to start up there at the end, and I'm going to introduce Jessica Halpern first. There's Jessica. She is the outgoing Witness Ministries Program Associate at the UUA. As the Reproductive Justice and Economic Justice staff person at their office in Washington, D.C., she works with interfaith and secular partners to coordinate advocacy opportunities for UU congregations and activists. So she's been a lifelong UU lay leader. She grew up in Pittsburgh, and she earned a degree from Earlham College. She is also one of the Women's Federation's Clara Barton interns, a position she held in 2012 and 2013, and during which time she spearheaded and wrote much of the UUA reproductive justice curriculum. So thank you for that, Jessica. All right, and Beth Dana next is a lifelong UU. She serves as Minister of Spiritual Life and Community Involvement at First Unitarian Church of Dallas. She joins the board of the UUWF this month as the Vice President for Leadership Development. And Beth, I have to tell you, we are really grateful to you for reducing the average age of our board members dramatically.
My pleasure.
All right. And next, we have the Reverend Dr. Tracy Sprouls. Did I say that right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. She has served UU congregations for over 26 years, and she is currently serving the First Unitarian Society of Plainfield, New Jersey. She is active in the UUA, in the district levels, and interfaith groups, and has been the chair in the past of the UUWF Margaret Fuller Awards panel. She has held many other positions of leadership and service throughout the UU movement and throughout the wider U.S. community, and she has won an award for her continuing support of GLBTQA work in Alabama. She is a published writer and is developing a social justice blog for the New Jersey Courier newspaper. And I think she's going to be invited to be a guest blogger for the UUWF blog soon. She says that family is important and keeps her grounded amongst all her many laudable and demanding activities. All right. Now, finally, I'm going to introduce my good friend and colleague, Reverend Marty Keller, whose project, the New Prophetic Sisterhood, is really under her passionate leadership. She is a UUWF, that's not right. I'm sorry, Marty. What is that? Anyway, I think you did tell me to say this, so I'm going to say this. Reverend Marty Keller joined the UUWF as our affiliated minister about a year ago. This is a new program that I don't believe that the UUWF has had affiliated ministers before, and she has been a very remarkable presence with our board. We're very happy to have her in that position. So she joins the ranks of professional clergy who are serving UU covenanted organizations and covenanted community work. You know, the Beyond the Congregations movement that the UUA has been talking about for a while now. She is involved in that. And this is a way that grows a progressive faith movement beyond the walls, the brick and mortar walls of our congregation. So that's what Marty has been doing in the last year or two. Prior to her ordination, she was a community person. She worked as a journalist. She worked for Planned Parenthood for many years. She worked in social justice. She wrote for newspapers. She was an activist, and also, I should say, she's a poet. Not only that, she is really my good friend. So, Marty, I would like to introduce you and let you,
thank you,
take over the microphone.
Thank you, Kirsty.
Yeah.
Is Cynthia Grant Tucker with us today?
Hi.
Could you stand up and get acknowledged? Okay, so my eternal gratitude for so many reasons to Cynthia, but on behalf of the many women ministers who had it on a required reading list, or at least our optional reading list, if there are other women-identified ministers in the house who read her book as part of our reading.
She can't see. They can't see.
Okay. Okay.
I'm not going
Sorry.
To do that, though.
So you heard me acknowledge Cynthia Grant Tucker, and I wanted to know how many women-identified ministers we have in the House and how many of you chose to read Cynthia's book, Prophetic Sisterhood, as part of our... I think it was optional. Most of the reading's optional, but I was really personally very grateful that it was on the list. So it's her graciousness that allows me and us to use Prophetic Sisterhood, New Prophetic Sisterhood, because that was the title of her book. And it was a book that told the story of the Iowa Sisterhood, a group of women ministers, our earliest Unitarian and Universalist ministers, who, not being given an opportunity to take those cushy pulpits in New England, where most of them were trained, were sent out to the American heartland, places like Iowa and really cold prairie places, and created these amazing congregations, these congregations that were warm and intimate and had, you know, were like living rooms where people could have conversations, wonderful socially relevant worship, settlement houses like places where people learned to read and all kinds of things, and women talked prophetically about things like temperance, which was a feminist issue then, and suffrage and women and prison reform and things like that. Am I being accurate in describing that? So what happened to these women is they got out there and did a bang-up job, and the men eyed their pulpits, and so very gradually they were in many ways forced out, either because it was so hard to be a woman minister, they went out to do a job that they thought they were doing, and they were met with a lot of resistance. So a lot of them ended up dropping out and going to social work jobs and things like that. And that coupled with our American desire around the turn of the century to have a more robust masculine culture, and as she, Teddy Roosevelt and all that kind of stuff, our own Unitarian association became worried that the men were fleeing the congregations, and it was because there were too many women. And so for a very, very long time, we were not ordaining women at all. I don't know how many of you know how long it was, but it was many decades between that first robust, robust is kind of a masculine word, but planting of women in pulpits to just a desert. So there were so very few. I wanted to tell you that story because it's a really important story to many of us who were women ministers. It's both a prophetic tale and a cautionary tale. I wanted to let you know that because I spent my entire childhood, I'm a lifelong Unitarian, and I came into my first Unitarian congregation in Cedar Lane, Bethesda, Maryland, as a little tiny toddler. I never saw a female in the pulpit as a child, as a teenager, as a young adult, and as an adult. I never saw a female in the pulpit. I never did, so that wasn't a model for me. So I joined many, many women in coming into ministry later in midlife because I finally decided, I guess if I didn't see them, it doesn't mean that they don't exist. And that was my background coming into ministry. And so I didn't have models for women being ministers, and I didn't have models for women being prophetic in the pulpit. So my whole secular history before being a minister was in journalism, covering cultural issues, and being a social justice activist. I worked for Planned Parenthood for many years. My car was firebombed and blown up in front of me and my children. I worked in California. I was in the fields of social justice on behalf of women and children for many years. But I never, ever did any of that work in my own congregation as a layperson, not once. Because for whatever reason, there was a disconnect between the work I was doing on behalf of women and children out in the world and what I thought we should be doing in our congregations. And a lot of that, I think, had to do with the fact that there were no women in leadership, professional leadership. There were religious educators, but there were no women in the pulpit. And when I became a minister myself, and I am in my 18th year, part of it in pulpit and part of it in community ministry, I would have to say, and I will take responsibility for more of a desire to be assimilated as a regular minister, and I did not use my interest in gender that had been out in the secular world as a minister in my congregation. I am just owning my accountability on that. And so I can tell you that most of the time I have preached on women's issues in what month?
Women's March.
March. So I've done sermons on Margaret Fuller, and I've done sermons on the prophetic sisterhood, and I've done sermons on girls, by the way, from HBO series, and I just did a sermon on Frozen, which I think is an interesting thing to do. Yeah, it's one of my favorite sermons. But I really restricted my coming out with my own gender identity and using the pulpit and using the public forum, pretty much restricted to Women's History Month, feeling that I did not want to spend too much of my time being a woman in the pulpit, that I had a responsibility to be more of that. And in that regard, I have not done justice to gender equity as a minister. So that's one reason I became interested in that project. Last year, there was an amazing, amazing transformative panel that was sponsored by the Young Adult Ministries. And it was in Providence, Rhode Island, and it was called Crashing Waves. And women from different generations sat at a panel just like that and shared their stories. I was asked to represent the boomers. And I said, nobody represents the boomers. But I did share that actually when I was a young adult, I spent most of my time smoking pot and opposing the war in Vietnam, trying to get my then husband out of the draft. That the ERA was happening and abortion stuff was happening and I wasn't paying attention. So it was interesting. And it was really interesting for me to hear, especially the women ministers who were present, sharing their own takes on how they had used their ministries on behalf of women. So I wanted to thank Jess for helping to put together that workshop. That really inspired me. And also the fact that we have spent the last, 3 years, 4 years now on reproductive justice. It is my opinion that this association has spent almost no time as an association paying attention to this issue. There have been almost no statements issued. When Hobby Lobby came across on the Supreme Court, I didn't see us making a big fuss about it. So I just feel like it's time for me and I'm taking my own responsibility as a feminist, and it's time for my sister ministers to take first accountability for ourselves to do a better job and to pressure this association to pay attention to the issues that affect 50% of the women in this country and across the world. So. I'm going to just talk for another minute to turn it over to the rest of the panel. So being a feminist and being part of a feminist process, this was my idea. So this was my really cool idea, a new prophetic sisterhood with at least 100 fellowshipped women-identified clergy being part of this movement. And 100 seemed reasonable. There are 1,800 fellowshipped UU ministers, and over half, 61% are women. So it felt like at least 100 of us would be willing to covenant to affirm and promote equity and justice for women and girls, right? And to support our spiritual growth. So that was my whole thing. And I wanted it to be ministers so that we could echo the prophetic Iowa sisterhood. Just a nice, lovely, literary thing. So it's not like we don't welcome lay women leadership. I want you to know that. You know, lay women have been doing amazing things in this movement, and congratulate yourselves for all the work you've been doing. This is an effort to hold my sister ministers accountable, for us to hold ourselves accountable. And so this was my dream. So I said, I'm not going to go any further. What does it mean to be a coveted new prophetic sisterhood? What is the accountability? So I have gathered around me, along with my colleague Beth Dana, who this is a co-ministry, to gather a circle of women advisors. And so all of these women are part of our advisory group. So they're going to share their stories and where we go from here and what we do as this group of prophetic sisters has a lot to do with what this group of women decides is a reasonable thing. So that's my introduction, and I'm going to turn it over to Tracy.
There's a question.
We're actually going to do some small group work, and that's where some of that will happen, and then we'll have questions at the end. Yeah.
Thank you. So I was born into the world as a feminist right out of my mother's womb. I remember one of the first times that I talked about equal rights for women was in kindergarten when my friends were telling me they wanted to be nurses, which I love nurses, great for nurses, but I wanted to be a doctor. Why didn't they want to be a doctor? And a note went home to my mother that I was speaking out of turn. I also was born into a very patriarchal family. My father is very in charge of the family, and over the years that being in charge has passed down to my brother. Even though my brother has had a troubled life, lived basically in isolation in the middle of West Virginia, off the grid, I think they call it, doing whatever he does. And I've been overeducated and very busy and a responsible minister for 16 years and working in congregations as a lay leader for the other 10. And when my father was sick in the hospital 2 years ago, he turned to my brother to decide what should be done medically for him. So not that I'm bitter, but I'm like, what? So out of this, I felt like I always strived really hard to not be girl or boy, but just to be the best. And I worked really hard to just get the A+, or to ride my bike the fastest, or get to the top of the tree before any of the boys did. So I worked really hard just to be Tracy. So when I moved to New York City in 1989, I walked into the Community Church of New York and fell in love with Unitarian Universalism. And the second week I was there, Tracy Robinson Harris was in the pulpit. And I was blown away because, like you, I had never seen any women ministers in my life. I had no idea that women could be ministers. And I immediately said, that's what I want to do. I'd been studying medicine. I was at NYU. And I thought, I don't want to be a doctor. What I really want to do is be a minister. So 5 years later, I went to seminary. They don't let you do that the second week, the third week that you're in seminary. I mean, that you're in a church. But also, the first GA I went to was in 1993, and you were speaking on your book. And that changed my life. So thank you. Yeah. So Tracy Robinson Harris and Cynthia Grant Tucker's book, and I thought, okay, I'll go to seminary. When I went for my interview, the dean there, Dean Agnew, said to me, what does it mean to your ministry to be a woman? What do you bring to it? And that surprised me. I mean, it was an excellent question and 100% appropriate question, but I had worked all my life to not be a girl or a boy or a woman or a man, but the best, and to just be highly motivated to be me. And I really had to step back from that question for quite some time, because it was all confused. It was, I'm a woman and I accomplished this, so that must be what I bring. Or, you know, but there's a deeper part of being a woman that I hadn't really thought about. And I think that from that day in 1993, 94 until now, I've been focused on trying to, in myself and in other women, help us raise our voices to understand who we are and what we bring to whatever it is that we do. If it's motherhood, to claim that. If it's ministry, to claim that. If it's a student, you know, whatever it is, to claim that voice, because so many voices are not heard, and in a variety of ways, in a variety of people. So that's what has been important for me. When I was ordained, I guess in 2000 is when Diane Miller ran for president. Does anyone remember that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, a couple of you. So she was not the first woman to run for president. Yeah, it was Carolyn. Yeah. But so I worked very closely on her campaign, and the stuff that we got from people, you know, how dare you talk about a glass ceiling? How dare you talk about equal rights for women? We're all equal in this day and age. It was surprising, the pushback that we got in 2000 from this election, and she did not win, as you know. We had an excellent president in Bill Sinkford. But when I walked around with her, she said to me, because we campaigned and I was like that second person who was with her everywhere she went. I even ironed her blouses before she before she made a talk. She says, do you know about the UU Women's Federation? No, I don't. You need to know. And that's how I got involved with that. Mm. And shortly after that, the Ministerial Sisterhood of UUs, which was for ministers, and that has since gone by the wayside, but I understand that there are a lot of younger women ministers who are now creating different kinds of groups and support groups, which was what the Ministerial Sisterhood was for when there were very few women in the ministry. But I want to jump up to what ministry looks like as a woman through the last few, the 16 years I've been a minister, just very quickly. When I was in Montgomery in 99 to 2003, the main topic of conversation, no matter what I preached on, was what I was wearing in the pulpit. I had women pay me for services, like a memorial services, by buying me clothes. Are you wearing hose? Are you not wearing hose? Your shoes are too high. They're too short. That slit in your skirt is too high. Just this constant conversation. The second one was trying to marry me off to, because I was a single minister, marry me off to one of their congregants, one of their sons, one of their nephews. So that could be a product of the South. It could be because it was 1999.
Stuff still happens today.
It's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. It happens to you.
It happens today.
Oh, well, no one's trying to marry me off anymore because I ended up marrying one of those Southern guys. So, so that stays with me that was okay for so many people, and that the women in the congregation thought that was okay. Then I was the minister of religious education in another congregation a bit later, from 2005 to 2009, so just more recently. And I was the religious education person, and each time I tried to talk at the board meeting, I was shut down. Mm-hmm. And now, that's just recently. But because I was a religious educator, which was traditionally a woman's role, and because I was the second minister there, not the first, it was often that I was not heard. And until the female minister repeated what I said, that was the only time people heard what I had to say. That was too recently. One more story. Then, just this past October. I've been in my congregation for 6 years. I'm in Plainfield, New Jersey. And we had a male administrator last year. And we have a female administrator this year who we hired at about $3,000 to $5,000 less because we were waiting for like a 3-month grace period until we knew she was going to stay. And then at the board meeting, the people on the board thought, well, why should we give her a raise? She's here. She's staying here. Why should she make that the same that the other person made? And we let this conversation go on for about 20 minutes, and then I had to stand up and say, I'm not accusing you of being sexist, but why on earth would you not pay this administrator as highly qualified as the other person the same amount that a man was made last year? So my closing remark is that ministry unfolded in me my power and helped me figure out who I was as a woman. And I think that's our role, is to come into our own as who we are, whether it's a woman or a man or whatever. And that even still, we have things to talk about and things to raise in our congregations and things to face up to in our own history. We talk about Black Lives Matter and our history and owning our history. We have to own our history around the sexism in our congregations. Thanks.
Okay. Hi, everyone. My name's Beth Dana. I am a younger woman minister, as you can see. I am 30 years old. Married to my wife, Erin, for 3 years, and mother to 2 dogs. And as you heard earlier, I am a lifelong UU, raised in Albany, New York, and educated in an all-girls school from pre-K all the way through 12th grade. When I went off to college, I decided that I wanted to break out of that, and so as much as my grandmother pressured me to go to one of the 7 sisters, I ended up going to a co-ed school. But my education took me around the country to various places, Ohio, Berkeley, California, New York City, and now I've landed in the middle in Texas. I am about to be ordained this fall by First Unitarian Church of Dallas. Oh, thanks. By First Unitarian Church of Dallas, where I currently serve as Minister of Spiritual Life and Community Involvement. And I wanted to begin by speaking a little bit about the context in which I'm doing ministry right now. Because First Unitarian Church of Dallas has an incredible history of women's leadership. And so it's been interesting for me to be in that place and finding out and sort of figuring out my place in that. So you heard about how the UU Women's Federation has been around for, 150 years or so. Well, the Women's Alliance at Dallas has been around for 1 year less than the church has been around. They were founded in 1900. And have been incredibly instrumental to the congregation. Particularly during the time of the Great Depression, it was really the Women's Alliance that financially and leadership-wise kept things going. this was, for a long time, a group that met in the daytime, but in the 1980s, the Women's Evening Alliance formed to serve women who were working outside the home and during the day. So we now have a Women's Day Alliance and a Women's Evening Alliance, who are separate but work together in so many ways. It was in these women's alliances that conversations began percolating that led to the Roe v. Wade case happening on a national level. So these are some incredible women, socially minded women, and creating an incredible community both within the church but also looking outward as well to serve the community and make change. For a couple of decades, the church was served by a senior minister, Laurel Hallman, and my current colleagues there, the Reverends Daniel Cantor and Aaron White, are both incredibly committed male allies, doing work for women's rights and reproductive justice, and working tirelessly in our community on that effort. And I'm really proud to serve alongside of them in the work that they're doing. And our church also has a history, a long history of involvement with the UU Women's Federation. Our women, particularly the lay women in the church, have been members of the UUWF for many years and in leadership. And that was how I came to, at this GA, join the board of the UU Women's Federation, is this lovely woman right here, Kathy Calhoun, came up to me and said, "Do you know about the UU Women's Federation? You should," and managed to recruit me in short time onto the board. So I feel like I'm standing in a long line and a real legacy of women's leadership at this church. And my ministry really, in a lot of ways, kind of stands on their shoulders and all that they have done and continue to do in our community. Now, being a young woman UU minister is interesting at this time. There are a lot of us, a growing number of us, which is really exciting, and a number of us having grown up in our UU faith too. But like Tracy talked about, some of the things that happened 20 years ago are still happening today, as far as inappropriate comments from congregants. Tireless comments on hairdo and attire and shoes and makeup and all of these things, which I don't think that my male colleagues get as much commenting on. When it comes to being a presence in the wider community, a part of my role is building my role in my ministry in Dallas is building interfaith connections and working with others to serve and to work for justice in the community. And I often find that when I'm out in these settings, it's mostly men. I'm usually one of the youngest people there. And I'm either too young or too female to be recognized as clergy. So I always have to introduce myself as such. It's never assumed. I'm also doing ministry at a very interesting time in our history and in the context of Texas. As you all know, the struggle for women's dignity and rights and choices continues. And it's not just, in Texas, it's not even just about access to abortions, though that's a huge part of it. Even women's preventative basic health care is being restricted. And these decisions are being made that are impacting women, but especially poor women and women of color. And we're also living, and I'm doing ministry in a time when there's a growing conversation about the complexity of gender, and a growing recognition that gender goes beyond the binary of man and woman. And so as somebody who is a cisgender woman, meaning the gender assigned to me at birth based on my biology and the gender expression and identity that I have today match, which they don't for everyone. So as a cisgender woman, part of my ministry and my life is to be an ally to others, particularly my transgender siblings, so that my work as a woman in ministry does not further marginalize anyone based on their gender. So we live in a world and serve in a denomination where we still have a long way to go until gender justice is achieved. And so I am realizing as I begin my ministry, really, that I have a role to play in this, a very important role. And so I was really honored when Marty invited me to join her in leading this new prophetic sisterhood and getting that off the ground. I'm realizing how important it is for women ministers to speak about the fact that we are women and to speak about issues that affect us, that affect women and girls, and that there are a lot of unique both challenges and opportunities to this role. I also believe in the power of women clergy coming together. So I'm a part of a number of mostly virtual online social media kind of communities of women ministers, of young women ministers, various things. And I can see how valuable those groups are and the fierce passion of the women in these groups. And I am hoping that the new prophetic sisterhood can be a way to channel and to amplify that in a lot of ways. And also similar to what my colleagues have said, I have not always had a lot of female clergy mentors until recently. And so I think that this is a great way for a lot of younger women ministers like myself to build those cross-generational mentor relationships. So I'm really excited to see a larger organized movement of women clergy working for gender justice and using the power that we have to make a difference in the lives of all of us, really. So thank you.
Can you hear me? Cool. Thanks. Well, what an honor to share a panel with these brilliant people. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Jess Halpern. I work for the Unitarian Universalist Association in our Office for Advocacy in Washington, D.C. And I am not a minister, and we're going to switch up the panel discussion just a little bit. I was asked to talk, to really wonder with you all about some of the benefits and the opportunities that could come with building this group of powerful women leaders to do public witness and advocacy work on behalf of Unitarian Universalism. And that question kind of brought to mind an experience that I had last April, which was when a lot of immigration reform activists were there were things happening on immigration. It was before President Obama made his action, so we were still hoping that comprehensive reform would be passed by Congress. And I and another woman minister within Unitarian Universalism were asked to be part of a group of women who would fast in a tent on the National Mall for 3 days. And we went and we were part of that, and we were the only people of faith, religious leaders, let's say, in the group. And the group was incredibly diverse. It was a lot of immigrants and people in immigrant families. There were business leaders, there were academics, there were family members, mothers and daughters, and we all gathered together. It was a very multilingual, multicultural group of people. And even though Boehner didn't give comprehensive immigration reform a chance to pass in the House, I felt that we were tremendously successful. We were there really witnessing for an immigration reform package that would be fair to women and families. So specifically talking about health equity in the bills, looking at Medicaid bans, and also looking at deportations and family unity. So those were our two main asks. And over the course of the 3 days that we were fasting in this tent, we made advocacy visits up to Capitol Hill, and we also had about 10 legislators actually come to our tent and want to hear our stories. And as the religious leaders, we were just leaving space for the people who were directly affected to share their heartbreaking stories of their families essentially being shattered by deportation, and the wage earners being deported so that they were in pretty desperate financial situations, and all sorts of other ways that the immigration system is pretty busted. And then also we had these 10 legislators came, and then we also were visited by Valerie Jarrett and Cecilia Munoz, who at that time was the senior Latino person in the White House, and also the domestic program advisor to President Obama. So we had some high-profile people come, and it was incredible to have the attention of those folks, and I think it was because we were women and we were fasting, because this is a matter of life and death for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So that's got me kind of wondering how powerful it could be to have a group of mobilized, of active, of organized, and kind of plugged in women leaders to be agitating both within Unitarian Universalism and external to our movement. And I think Marty, you're right. I think holding the UUA as a institution accountable, and also your colleagues in your congregations, mm-hmm. To hold them accountable as well, because we as Unitarian Universalism need to be transformed as much as anybody else. So as I was, you know, we've been wondering about, in the Office for Advocacy in Washington, D.C., we've been wondering about creating a rapid response team of people. And I would wonder if it could, if a team like this could have a similar function to be able to be in a position to be called on when something happens, like immigration reform passes, or when the White House makes a statement about contraception or anything else that's interesting, to be able to put letters to the editor in local papers across the country and build pressure on Congress, or to have advocacy visits at either at the district office or at the national office. To build relationships with not only legislators but other influencers. I mean, we know our clergy and our lay leaders as well are incredibly well connected in our communities, and we're well respected as well as well connected and well respected within our sort of collegial community. And then I was also sort of thinking that my office scrambles to put together prophetic or pastoral messages when something like the Supreme Court decision yesterday comes down. Like we're prepared for something that's that big most of the time, but when it's something even just slightly smaller, we're there wondering, you know, when Baltimore exploded, for example, we really needed to figure out what are we going to say? How are we going to respond? And if there was a group of women who were engaged and active and kind of plugged in, how different that response could be, and we could start being pastoral and prophetic, stepping into our power as Unitarian Universalists, working for justice in a very active way. Yeah. So those are some thoughts about how promising this could be, and I'm very excited. I was also kind of wondering, though, I know from experience that effective advocacy is done when we know who we are and what we have to bring to any given situation. And for us as Unitarian Universalists, we talk a lot about identity, right? We talk about what it is to be women, but we also talk about what it is to be multicultural, or what the difference that our racial identity makes, or what the difference is when if we are upper or upper middle class or educated, or if we're straight, working as allies in the LGBT movement. So it helps to know who we are so that we can bring those identities to the fore and either act as allies or speak into our power as a united group of people to make a difference. So understanding our identity and our power has two effects really on the advocacy that we can do. One, it has an effect on how we choose our advocacy priorities, so understanding our social and cultural location as we're saying, okay, reproductive rights, economic justice issues, and understanding kind of what the difference makes in all of that. And the second piece is it makes a difference in how we approach advocacy and who we partner with. So if we know who we are and we know who is directly affected, if it's not us, then we'll be able to partner more effectively and really understand what the crux of the situation is and how we can be helpful. Right, as Beth was saying about knowing herself as a cisgendered person and figuring out how to not further oppress people on the basis of gender identity in her ministry. So this sort of intersectional framework, this way of understanding the difference that difference makes, and sort of the overlapping overlapping systems of oppression of race and gender and class and physical ability and all of these things, that makes a huge, huge difference. And it can be really complicated. Some people have called it mission creep. Where we think we're going this way, but actually we're going to be going all of this way. And I fervently believe that it is not mission creep. If we think about it as mission creep, we have to wonder what mission are we on and whose mission is it, right? So this intersectional approach to justice making. Am I going on too long? I'm almost done. So this intersectional approach to justice making, I would say, is more accurate, right? We are not siloed beings. I am not someone who needs to make a living wage on Monday and someone who needs birth control on Wednesday. So we are not siloed beings. We are whole people, and so it is more accurate. The intersectional framework is also more faithful. We get to attend to whole people and their whole lived experience. And I think it is easier for us as people of faith in some ways to understand intersectionality than it is for maybe some of my secular advocate colleagues in DC. And thirdly, it's more strategic. I mean, if we can stand in our power and use our power and figure out how to be effective partners and allies, we can get a lot of stuff done. And it's sort of exciting to watch. There are certainly challenges. It makes teamwork absolutely necessary. My crew, I mean, we're in each other's business all the time. And so that's interesting. It also makes partnership absolutely necessary, and it makes building those personal relationships, the slow work of building trust and friendship, integral to good advocacy work. And you have to be continually open to transformation, as friendship calls us to be. But it really opens the door for an incredibly visionary and vital vitality, I wish I could bring you into the room with me when we're in these reproductive justice coalitions and everyone is stepping into their power the way that Tracy, you said that you did when becoming a minister helped you step into your womanhood. And it's like that, and it's just tenfold, so it's wonderful. Okay, that's all.
I really wanted just thank you very much to the panelists so far, and then we're gonna. I think Beth's gonna propose some questions.
Hidden behind the pulpit.
I'm hidden. I have vertical issues, right? So
vertically challenged.
I'm vertically challenged. We were gonna break you into small groups, but it's never really possible in these rooms. I mean, but this is a feminine process. Do you want to spend like 15 minutes doing what we were going to do?
Discussion in small groups,
or do you want to be part of a whole? Okay, fine. So this is how we roll. I appreciate all of the stories from all of my sisters. I want to thank them for that. And I really want to thank Jess because she brought up intersectionality. She and I have had interesting conversations about that. So this is what I want to say, what I've been getting from this DA and before, and that is we don't want to be in silos. And that's what we're trying to do. But here's my concern. I don't want gender equity to get lost in the discussion about intersectionality, okay? So that I'm just putting it out there, you know. I worry about it a little. I see it happening, I do. And so the extent to which we can be part of a justice whole, because that's being a whole person and a whole movement, I'm all down with it. But I am here to say that we need to do the work of gender equity at the same time. So that's something that's gonna be a challenge. So I thank you for setting that conversation going. So I think that we are going to take questions and comments, and there's a mic. Everything is recorded because we're part of the GA programming, so you need to come to the mic and if you can.
Hi, I'm Cynthia Grant Tucker. A question, Marty, I'll let you navigate this so that you can pass it on to whomever you like. But I think we all agree that it is the feminist paradigm rather than chromosomes that determines whether we feel that actions, mindset, decisions are compatible with what we would like to see. And to that end, I would hope that there could be some instrument indeed, to mainstream this is something central to formation for ministry. As the late Eleanor Artman observed in one of the last pieces that she wrote, she said, "We worked so hard for us women to get access to ministry, and then a lot of women left their feminisms at the door, down below, as they moved up into the pulpit. It would seem to me it would be a wonderful thing if we could call collectively for courses in seminaries, maybe put one together or something, that would have men and women be mindful of the compatibility of the feminist paradigm. Mm. What does that really mean? Not issues out there, but really mean, and to empower women not to leave their feminisms down below.
So thank you. And it sounds to me like maybe, you know, we could have some quick responses about, so how well, what did that happen for you in your training? You know, it maybe start from there. What did I get training in that? So I would say I went to Candler School of Theology. It's a Methodist-based seminary. It's 60% of us still go to theological schools that are not UU. And I would say that I had one class actually in feminist theology. I did. I had an entire semester class on that, but that was it, and it was not required. It was an optional class. So I don't know if you wanted to respond.
I had feminist theology, and I had feminist professors in my seminary, but that question from the very beginning stayed with me through the whole process. So I was asking questions from that perspective.
From that theology, how that practice.
No.
As much of that.
Well, I would just say the one thing that comes to mind right away is how some people do ministry, that some men, generalizing, are less relational. And from your book, I think that was very clear that women are much more relational, conversational. And I'm still talking to people. I'll be talking to my president, and he wants to A, B, C, get it done. And I'm like, how are you? Let's relate together. Let's have a conversation. And it's really hard to try to pull these people who are very process and goal-oriented into the relationship. So I think that's maybe something that you're talking about.
I guess I'll just say, yeah, aside from the sort of scholarly feminist theology stuff, the class that I think probably helped me to own this as much was not an explicitly, it wasn't a class explicitly about that, but it was taught by an incredibly feminist professor, and it was a communication class. And it was all about how we communicate with our fullest selves, like not just, you know, planning what we're gonna say, but how we tap into who we are and what we really have to say, and to channel that power. And that is an incredibly feminist thing, I think. Yeah. And it was a great class.
It's wonderful. We have about 15 minutes and a lot of people in line. So if you could ask questions as succinctly as possible, then we can work our way.
Say your name and congregation.
If you want to, name and congregation. And we'll try to get us through as many as possible.
Hi, Christy. I'm Linda Burgum. I'm from East Shore, which is in Bellevue, Washington. And I'm a baby boomer who has been an advocate for and an activist on feminist issues and proud to be a feminist since I was old enough to understand and say the word. And then it seems in my lifetime that it's become a dirty word and that your generation in particular has been reluctant to use it. So I'm very glad to see you here. I'm glad to see this workshop on this topic, and I wish that there were 15 or 20 of them happening this weekend instead of this one. So thank you for that. All of you have talked about your role in the ministry and as you use, and some reluctance to use your feminine power to speak to feminine issues and to advocate for more feminine issues in UU and UUA. And I'm glad that you're thinking about it. I'm glad that you're struggling with it, but you've also referred to you say half the population, and I think you're talking about the general population of women in this country. Does UUA do any tracking by gender of our congregations? In my observation, in the 6 or 8 that I've been to, we are way over half of the congregation. So
I believe we have, and it's pretty high. You know, but in some congregations, maybe 80%. You know, it's
right.
So you point out something really important. And
think about the demographic of our congregations and who you're serving, and let that empower you to be even more of an activist.
And
for
actually, that is worrying people. So remember Cynthia's story of the Iowa Sisterhood. We are where, so prophetic can be two things. Prophetic is like being, you know, prophetic and making change. It also can be a warning, right? Mm-hmm. And so the warning we got from the Iowa Sisterhood is that they were looking at the same paradigm of having a high percentage of female congregants and wondering whether that's because we were getting too feminized. So it can be looked at as a wonderful thing, and it can be looked at as like we're doing something wrong. So,
I just want you to be aware of the demographic of the congregations
that
you serve.
Absolutely.
So, my name's Katie Larcel. I'm a recently ordained minister. Yay. I got to walk in this. Yes. And I'm from East Rose, here in town. And something that's been growing on me, and it's one of the reasons why I came to this particular workshop, is that I read in the paper often about some poor woman, maybe even with her children, being shot and killed by her partner. And that happens almost routinely in all of our cities, and yet you don't see anybody march about it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something we should think about. Mm-hmm. You know, what if we marched? What if we had candlelight vigil every time one of those poor women were killed?
Thank you. My name is Vicki Schlossen from the UU Fellowship in Corvallis, and my question is about language. So decades ago, I was ecstatic when we started using gender-neutral language. Mm-hmm. Now I am beginning to see it as erasing the female experience. And I'll give you a very small thing that happened in our fellowship. So decided to sing a song that was from a goddess theology, and all the pronouns were changed. So first of all, as a teacher, the grammar was wrong. But to try, you know, and when I complained about it, it was like, well, we don't want to have the men feel left out. So I don't know if you've experienced that, what you think about that, but that is just my concern, is that we're overshooting this. It's just something to think about. So, you know, I felt unwelcome at that worship because I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there as a woman.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It is a huge challenge. I bump into it fairly often in the reproductive justice work that we do. And in particular, as one example, you all remember the statement of conscience that was passed on reproductive justice just a few days ago. And you'll notice that most of the time in the statement, when we're referring to someone who could be pregnant, we use gender-neutral language. Because women are not the only people that can get pregnant. Mm-hmm. That is real, right? Mm-hmm. Because many, many trans men have the female reproductive system still inside them. And they've opted not to do the kind of surgery because they don't feel like their identity calls for it. You know, there's so many complex decisions related to all of this. And the queer and transgender community there were 12 trans women of color murdered in the first 14 weeks of 2015. Mm-hmm. This is a real, real problem. And I hear your point. I mean, it's absolutely true. How do we talk about patriarchy in a gender-neutral way? It's just a challenge, you know. It is a hard thing to do, and I think there is value in giving real voice to women's experience and to transgender and genderqueer experiences. Mm. Yep, there's a way to do it. There's space for all of us. Mm. There's got to be.
Hi, my name is Navara, and I'm from the Humboldt Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in California, and I have sort of a comment or a hope that for your sisterhood projects. One of the things I noticed is that most of you talked about not having female clergy members. And there's my congregation until very recently was lay-led, so we didn't have any clergy. And while we did have a lot of very strong female leaders, I think having clergy members and a strong female clergy member is a great role model and someone to look up to. And I would hope that you could reach out online or something to maybe put sermons of women clergy members online and reach out to congregations so that young women who don't have that access can access anyone that they want to and be inspired by the lovely people that you are.
Actually, I'm really glad you brought that up because I haven't checked it out with my sisters yet, but that was one of my dreams. was to have a platform for sermons and other we have a website plan and a Facebook page plan, and we even have a logo plan, but you see I'm checking it out with them, so thank you for thank you.
My name is Pat Lindgren. I'm with the Surprise Arizona UU Church. I've been a UU for 8 years. I was treasurer of my church for 4 years. I'm running for president next year. I'm a worship leader and I give sermons, and this is my fourth GA. And until I walked in this room this morning, I never heard of UUWF. Mm-hmm. We're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. Whoever's in charge of UUWF. Sorry.
I'm Stephanie Wilson. I'm from Heritage UU Church in Cincinnati, and I was introduced and became enthralled with UUism through Eleanor Artwin. So she retired from the pulpit from our church, and she was the first lady minister. You know, I had never heard of such a thing, which was part of the attraction to start there. So anyway, when she left and we were the search committee was trying to find another minister. I was hoping very, very much it was going to be another woman, and it wasn't. And at first he came, they were tough shoes to fill. And he held a lot of resentment, I think, for Eleanor in that we loved her so much, and he was a guy, and there wasn't a whole lot he could do about that. So anyway, I really don't know why, but it seems like he has wanted us to become very active and do helpful, wonderful things, mostly in the Cincinnati community. But after listening to you all, I realized they aren't really women issues. I mean, not that that makes it a bad thing. So we have, and probably a lot of churches do, a Clara Barton Guild that we tell all the ladies in our congregation that they're all automatically a member of that, but it seems like the core of the group and the most of us that are really active in it did come during Eleanor time. So I don't know if that's the reason or not, but most of the things that we take on now, we also raise money to do church things like put in a new rug or blah, blah, blah. But we've also done worldwide stuff like sew dresses to send to young women in poor countries and all that. So after all that, I guess my question is mostly for Jess. I would like to know if we all sat down, we're trying to get the younger women involved in the Clara Barton Guild too, because it seems like it's mostly the retired, middle-aged women that come. How do we decide, or should I say, we're never going to completely solve an issue that we try to advocate for, but how do you feel, how can we spread ourselves around, or do we spread ourselves around? Do we vote on one issue that we should put all of our energy into, or do we choose a couple of our favorites, or how do you narrow that down so you can actually do some good?
Well, my first thought is to ask, where are the relationships of members and leaders of your congregation with organizations in your community of that are led by marginalized folks? So where are you? Do you have relationships with climate justice
and just climate justice organizations in your community, or reproductive justice organizations in your community, or immigrant justice organizations. So if you have relationships, if you have friends that kind of bring you into accountable relationships with those people, with those leaders and organizations, that's a great place to start, is to partner and have that relationship, that covenant, be the foundation of your justice work. So that's one way to kind of go about it. It's a challenge, though, to feel like
we're
going to
have
productive.
We're just going to have to take the last question.
That's good.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really, that's a good question.
I'm Doreen Sulzer, and I'm from San Diego, First Unitarian. I've been the chair of the UUWF for a number of times. I'm an RN, I'm a lawyer, but I feel very disconnected from the UUWF at the national level. And the people in my group in San Diego, we have a group that say, I don't want to donate to national because I have no connection. And then when I hear that we have no staff person at the UUA, but we want to give more money to other, you know, to other women for projects, and we don't have any connection with you, what can you do to make that better? Can we get a staff person in there halftime? Can I have a name of somebody I can call if I have to? Or, you know, are we just hanging out there?
Well, I'm going to, you know, it's a good question. Kirstie Lewis is here. She's our president, to have that conversation. We actually do have a paid staff person, so we do have an administrator, and our grant funding program's gone on for a dozen years. So that's
she's
just.
A paid staffer. She's not paid by us. There's been a recent change. We had an administrator for 37 years, and she retired. Yeah, so it'll take time to find somebody new. So we have
the internship. Are you asking about the internship? So really,
no.
Okay, I think she's asking about the UWF administrator.
Right.
So,
okay.
So.
We'll put the website and the Facebook page and all that.
Okay. Okay, so we have a very easy to access website, www.uuf.org, and it's got a lot of information. I do a blog all the time. It's got an application, most important to me right now, two things. The issue survey is on the website. We have an active Facebook presence, so we have a Facebook page, and on the website is for all of you who have women-identified ministers who are not in this room, who you want to encourage to be part of the New Prophetic Sisterhood. There's an application to be part of it, so there's that available on our website. And as I said, we have an active Facebook page, yes.
Does that mean you don't have to be a clergy member? I'd like to join, but
no.
To be part of the UUWF.
To be part of UUWF, of course you can be a lay member. To be part of the New Prophetic Sisterhood is a clergy-based group, yeah. But the application is on the website. Yeah. Right.
Long-time feminist,
right.
And we think you need to be doing a lot more.
Right.
UUA is a patriarchy.
Understand. Understand.
You got to get in there and you got to fight.
Okay, understand.
And the lay leaders know it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
we are working with lay leaders. This is a project, one of our projects, okay? That's what I said at the beginning. It is one of our projects. It is not our only project. This is one project, yeah. Yeah, take the survey. We are still actively involved in lay projects, yeah. Okay, we are over,
and we are
so
on.
I really
thank
appreciate
you.
It, and thank you for coming.
The passion in the room.
Because she said she wants us to fight. That's what we're doing.
Yeah.
No. Full fellowship.
Yeah.
Where are you? You said you were ordained, right? You're ordained and in fellowship. Oh, not final fellowship. Oh,
no. Just preliminary fellowship.
I was so excited to see a broad array of agents from here.
Yes, just go on the website.
About that.
Yes.
So, that's a good word.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a bridging thing. What are the questions? know, because I think in Omaha, Nebraska, it's very white, it's very conservative, it's very male-driven, and in our congregation, we now have a wonderful interim minister, Reverend Frieda Gillespie, and it's awesome. But I'm just wondering, because that balance between identifying feminist issues or women's issues, I mean, how do you really go about working with the congregants, or is it just really having a conversation to find out what those issues might be? Because I think many of us have fallen asleep if we've already kind of gone through, you know, and have advanced in our careers, and that part of it's okay. But I don't know about the other people in the congregation and how they're feeling and what they're experiencing.
I would ask them.
Yeah, might be the only way.
Hi, Darcy. Yeah. So you find out what concerns them, what they're experiencing, what's important to them. Yeah. I mean, that's what this.
So cool.
This is not for, you know, the survey that she kept talking about. That is the Women's Federation's effort to survey women you use everywhere, clergy and lay women, about what is important to them. But you can do something similar within your congregation or ask them to do this, you know. Yeah. Yeah. It's online, so we don't have paper versions. But,
I saw it on my phone.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's on there. We're asking folks to do it online just because then all the results, you know, get in there electronically automatically.
I'll take a computer to my... We only have one women's group in my church. It's Lush, and we go drink beer together on Tuesday.
There's all kinds of women's groups, right?
Yeah. I'll just pass around and take a positive.
That sounds great. Awesome. Yeah. Let me come down off this.
So the conversations about gender neutrality came out of women's and pronouns never being female. So there was an effort to balance it, and now we're into a whole new.
It is about literally in my election.
That's right.
We shouldn't even be on that trajectory.
Yeah.
We should be doing, as always, we need to change the paradigm, but to even ask it's part of our language. We can't get forward
right
if we're going for neutrality.
Right.
This is
very interesting.
But I think having just helping people with this new world, this is how we celebrate the creativity that's going on.
That's right.
And for our brothers and sisters who are gender irrelevant, then let's go with that too.
Right.
Anyway, gorgeous. I love that.
Women's Federation is about doing the prophetic work. This circle was about recreating the Iowa Sisterhood to remember prophetically, for good or ill, what happened. And because women ministers, I think, have been complacent. And they said, we've been like 61% and whatever. And so I'm saying, all I wanted to do as a minister was to organize my sisters and to let lay women know, to pressure their minister. You know. And I was... What really happens in the Black church? The Black church is 90% female, and it's the most patriarchal.
And those women are more predominantly elders as well. So the call to serve elders.
Right. So you see, I think a lot of older women in you feeling very marginalized. Very marginalized because we are the majority, and we're being you know, thrown under the bus a lot. There's a lot of throwing under the bus. So that's
anyway, what a great comment. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much.
I can't wait to see where you are next year.
Thank you. Thank you. You want me to go with you? They'll meet you back in the room. Okay, wait for me and I'll walk. So I'm glad you came.
Right on, right on.
Thank you. Like a feeling.
Freedom. I'll see you around.
No good deed goes unpunished right now, is what I say.
Yeah, I know. That's an odd saying now, and I
well,
don't be so hard on yourself. I thought you were hard on yourself.
Oh, I'm just trying. I appreciate that. Actually, when I was in my secular life and when I was a journalist, I was much braver. That's what I'm saying. And when I write, when I blog, I feel less. So there's something about stepping into this institution. And I feel like it is because of role models. And because, you know, I really realized when I was writing it, it was that I wanted to be a semi-like. You know? So, yeah. And well, I'm also Jewish, too. So I'm a Jewish, I'm a female. And like, so I could stand up here and talk about how I don't use my Jewishness until I got Skinner House book, where now I am the Jew. Okay, so now I have to talk about Jewish. See, I understand the challenge because then I'm the Women's Federation Minister, only people want me to do is talk about women's stuff. And I loved not having to do that all the time. And then I put the book out about being a Jew, and like, I'm the Jew. My son's a stand-up comic, and he's the Jew. That's his whole thing. He's the Jew. So I'm either the Jew or the woman. So, you know, and so we want to not be pigeonholed, but on the other hand, we can take it, roll it back way the other way, and so I attempted to roll it back in.
Yeah, well, I think we all do.
We all
do because we're trying to balance these two incredibly passionate beliefs.
Right.
And how do you?
And to be a full human and to think and talk about whatever I want to think and talk about. So thank you. I don't feel like I'm hard on myself, but I think I was trying to model it. I was trying to model it.
Oh, thanks.
Thank
you for coming today.
No, you're welcome.
Thank you.
I'm trying to.
if anybody needs a little pick-me-up, I have chocolate, bags of chocolate on the front rows. If you want to pick it up and pass it around. It's the good ones with the little notes on the inside.